You know as much as you can.
Okay, good afternoon. I'm opening a meeting of the House Higher Ed and Workforce Development Committee on Thursday, March 9th, 2017. And just for the notes, Rep. Alonzo Leon is sick and will not be joining us today. So,
take a picture of it.
Last Tuesday, we heard about a number of different student pathways. And today, we have a number of bills that somewhat relate to that. So we have probably about 20 minutes to share each of those bills. And so that's pretty good. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2789. And Laura, could you read the bill? And Senator, would you like to join us?
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2789.
Excuse me, did I gavel?
Yeah, you did. You hit something, boom.
I'd do it again.
You know why I know? Mr.
You can't over-gavel.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair.
Opening a public hearing on House Bill 2789.
You know why I know you gavel? Because I haven't been here to hear it very often. So.
My first time, too.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Okay. Proud
Chair,
of you guys.
I was thinking about leaving.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2789 would require Department of Education and the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to establish by rule career and technical education pathways.
Welcome, Senator. Good
Thank
to have you.
You
with us.
Thank you, Chair Reardon. That's
a nice
so
ring
is this
to
my
it.
First
nice
time before to this committee today, this year? Yep. That's great. Well, it's great to see you all. Actually, just a couple of holdovers from the good old days when I was part of this committee. But it's
your Republican friends.
that's absolutely right. Those who have tenacity. So I'm Michael Dembro. I'm the senator for District 23. That's Northeast and Southeast Portland. And happy to talk to you about this bill because this bill is kind of a logical next step to the work that this committee has been doing for a number of years. As many of you know, this committee took a real lead in our efforts to reinvest as a state in career technical education, focusing certainly at the high school and middle school, high school level. But our intention all along was to create real pathways of opportunities for young people that would begin in K-12 and that would extend into college and apprenticeship. And to that end, we created the CTE Revitalization Grant Program, and a core part of that program was creating partnerships between school districts and employers, between school districts and community colleges, between school districts and labor, because we understand that what creates success is those two P's, partnership and pathway. And the revitalization grants were really designed to encourage that, to use the grant process to get school districts to forge those partnerships, to create those pathways. What we're asking for in this bill is, as I said, to kind of take it to the next level, to really get the K-12 world and the higher education world to come together and create real pathways for career technical ed so that it becomes very clear what happens where and how real pathways can be created. One of the bills, I don't know, some of you may remember, we passed several years ago, would encourage the practice of having joint industry advisory committees for K-12 and for community colleges. You may or may not know that one of the features of career technical ed, it's a federal requirement, is that each career program has an industry advisory committee, and that industry advisory committee is designed to advise on curriculum, in some cases, help provide technical expertise and equipment, and ideally down the road, provide employment for graduates. That's required of each high school program, It's also required of each community college program. And you have many instances in which, you know, an area will have, you know, let's say in welding, you'll have, you know, each school district in an area will have its industry advisory committee. The community college will have its industry advisory committee. And the thinking there was, behind the bill that we passed a few years ago, was maybe those should be coordinated, you know, in a more regional basis, so that, first of all, you weren't depleting the goodwill of industry, you know, by forcing them to be on multiple advisory committees, but also to really be able to create the pathways. So, yeah, this part of the curriculum belongs here at this level. This part of the curriculum belongs here at that level. And what, you know, as I envision this legislation, that would really take those kinds of considerations to the next level in creating true pathways within different occupational areas. So I'll stop there, and we can hear from John, and then I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, great. Mr. Wyckoff.
Chair Reardon, members of the committee, for the record, John Wyckoff, Deputy Director of the Oregon Community College Association. And I'd first like to thank Senator Dembro for his work on this legislation and for the committee in the attention that you all have paid to various pathways into post-secondary education and the overlap between higher education, post-secondary education, and workforce. And I think this bill really sort of speaks to that. It's a really straightforward concept. It just simply says that the Department of Education and the Higher Education Coordinating Commission will come together and make recommendations for how to align CTE courses in the high schools to CTE in community colleges to the greatest degree practicable. As Senator Dembro pointed out, we have, through various efforts, more attention being paid to CTE programming at the secondary education level. We think that's great, but we just want to make sure that there are direct paths to community college programs, because I think it's important to remember that, you know, today a high school CTE program isn't just sort of wood shop. Not anything against wood shop, but they're high tech. These are high tech jobs that that students are leading toward, and they require some post-secondary education, maybe not a 4-year degree, but usually at least a post-secondary certificate or 2 years of education forward. And so this isn't about reaching into the money that has gone into the high school or that maybe going into high school CTE. It's just about aligning the program so that there is a direct path. And I think it's in many ways similar to the work that this committee is doing around a college credit transfer. But what I would say is I think on that work, we're just about a step farther down the road. And this is about getting together the K-12 side and the post-secondary side together and say, okay, let's figure out the roadmap to make to how we're going to create this alignment. And I think and come up with sort of the specific proposals for how to get there, the kind of specific proposals we all have been talking about around college credit transfer and that bill is working toward. And so this is really just sort of to create the roadmap to do the same thing around CTE programs from the high school to post-secondary level. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Rep. Reschke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Dembro and John, for coming. My question is, I'm new here, so I don't have the history that some on the committee do or you guys do. So can you help me understand a little bit better how this complements Measure 98 or works with Measure 98 in some fashion?
Well, I would say, first of all, that Measure 98, I would say, is kind of the result of work that we've done here in the legislature to refocus attention on CTE. And in that refocusing, I think we've come to really understand the value of CTE and investments in CTE, the understanding that young people who go through CTE programs, full programs, graduate at a far higher rate than the general population. The CTE grants that were out there provided such demonstrable success that I think that helped pass the passage of Measure 98. You know, I think my understanding is, and I've not been directly involved in the rulemaking around Measure 98. I think there's a meeting tomorrow, actually, on that subject. I'll be interested in seeing how, you know, how that work coheres with the work that we've been doing. You know, one concern that I have potentially around Measure 98 is there's a sum of money that's just going to be spread out among the different high schools, and it could lose focus. And that would be a concern that I have. If we can, you know, make sure, however those Measure 98 dollars are deployed, if they can be done in a way that really exercises the creativity of the districts and, you know, where they're really doing, you know, real substantial investments and not just, you know, scattering around $1,000 here, $1,000 there, that would be my concern. And what we're talking about here in this partnership between K-12 and community colleges is, I think, a very strategic approach to how to be successful. So I think that I think those two processes are really going to have to cohere.
Thank you.
Rep. Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to follow up on Representative Reschke's question, I was going to ask that same thing because I guess I'm concerned about having another parallel effort with DOE and the HEC working on career technical pathways while we do have that effort going on in Measure 98 implementation too. And I'm not saying they're not compatible, but I do think they could be in conflict with one another, and there could be work going on that could be, it needs to be better alignment. I'd feel much better if this was a part of that, because as you were saying, and from my perspective, the reason why I'm working on the rule implementation is we don't want that investment spread. We want to have outcomes, you know, because the voters were pretty clear about what they wanted. They want to improve graduation rates, and they saw CTE as being the prime pathway, I think, to doing that. So I don't think it's a bad concept, but I think we need some alignment with this because we're at a critical juncture now. And if we get Measure 98 fully funded, as I hope we will, we've got to make sure that we're on going in the right direction, and we don't have folks here in Salem working on a pathway while we have ODE and school districts working on another implementation pathway on 98 and so forth, because it's too important to get this crossways. But that was just more of a statement, I guess, but I would say, too, the other missing ingredient I would see would be some sort of industry input in what you're proposing here in 2789. So it's not just folks in, you know, the buildings here in Salem that are guessing what kind of career pathways are good for where we ought to be preparing kids. We need some industry input so we know, for, you know, not just what exists today, but what's the careers of 10, 15 years from now going to look like? Because we're always a step behind, it seems, in preparing our workforce and aligning our education with that. So I feel much better if there's some kind of industry input, at least, within this process.
Representative Johnson, I think that that makes a lot of sense, and I think from the community college perspective, we sort of look at it as well. On some level, it's implied we have for every CTU program an industry advisory council, but I wouldn't see any reason why you wouldn't specifically call it out in doing something like this.
Sure.
And I very much also agree with your sentiment that it needs to, in the same way we're trying to align programs, it needs to align with the work that's already going on. That, in fact, in some ways, the passage of 98 was part of the impetus for this because we just wanted to make sure as this kind of these revitalization efforts are going on, that we have an eye to that. And I think we had felt that in some of the, at OCCA, that in some of the really early conversations, that just wasn't enough of the part of the conversation. I think that's beginning to change. And so I think we would see this as wanting to be as complementary to that effort as possible.
And then just to follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yep, certainly.
And John, you mentioned it earlier in the degree or the credit transfer topic too, that it really should play a role in this as well, because as we talk about CTE, as we talk about dual credits that are within the CTE realm, we again want to make sure that anything that's being earned at that K-12 level has a positive value going forward, that's either at community college or a technical program or something, just so they're not just, you know, credits for credit's sake.
Yeah.
And if I could respond,
please,
Mr. Chair, I think that's another very good point that Representative Johnson is raising. You know, one of the beauties of the revitalization grant program is that those decisions are made by a group that includes educators and it includes industry people, you know, in partnership. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's we definitely would want to draw on the expertise of that group who've been working on CTE, you know, both coming out of the education world, but also from industry and labor.
Yeah. And I think one of the values of this related to Measure 98 is Measure 98 technically is grades 8 through 12. And we know that it has to align with community college and college work. So I think there's definitely some value there. As far as I was just had to chuckle a little bit when you mentioned welding. Tuesday, we had this awesome presentation, and it was from Community College showing the welding curriculum, and it was like mapped out what the advisor would look at, what the student would look at on their career pathways, and I thought, I think our work is done, you know? It's like, probably not. We'll find something to do. So they're doing some great work out there, and this would probably support that. So thank you. So anything else? All right.
Thank you.
I'd like to call up Kirsten Espen. I should look at these names ahead. Kirsten Espen Green and Joel Fisher.
Thank you.
Pardon me for the butchering of your name.
No worries. I'll be really brief so that you can keep to your 20 minutes per bill. I submitted the testimony.
And I have to ask you to properly pronounce your name.
Certainly.
For the record.
Kirsten Aspengren.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So I just want to say that I'm very honored to be here to testify today in support of House Bill 2789. I work at the Educational Policy Improvement Center. We're a nonprofit here in Oregon based in both Eugene and Portland. And we've been around for about 15 years looking at the alignment from secondary to post-secondary. We were founded by Dr. David Conley, who is a national expert in college and career readiness. And I just, you know, we've done a lot of work around curriculum alignment, looking at what students need to know and be able to do in order to succeed after high school. And the piece that we're consistently seeing nationwide that's really missing is how to connect the chasm between secondary and post-secondary. And I was at a meeting here at the state capitol not too long ago that brought together community colleges and high schools that are doing curriculum alignment work. And one of the things that really struck me at that meeting was when someone said that there's this age-old adage where students are told once they get into their 101 course in post-secondary to forget everything that you learned in high school. And that is something that we really need to break in order, particularly in CTE, in order to create these talent supply chains that we need to really be forward thinking around workforce preparation. And the last piece that I just want to bring up is that recently the state of California hired EPIC to do a study to look at the best indicators for college and career readiness, so not just focusing on the college post-secondary readiness, but really looking at that career piece as well, as the state of California is revising its entire local accountability plan. And in that study, we found that the single best indicator for college and career readiness is integrated pathways across the institutions. And I think that the state of California really heard that those results and have integrated CTE pathways as one of the indicators for local accountability plans throughout the state of California. And so we've been doing work directly with districts to bring together not just the high school teachers and the instructors, but also local workforce experts to really talk about what students need to know and be able to do at every step of that pathway, and really try to not put the onus on the student to make the connections, and so that we can really use the collaboration within the integrated pathways to reinforce that course-taking behavior that is so important in order for students to not just complete their pathway, but also be actually prepared to enter into the workforce.
Thank you for being here, and please say hello to Dr. Conley.
I will.
We worked together at David Douglas back in the 90s.
Oh, wow. So, yeah, I'm actually meeting with him next week.
He was very smart back then, too. So.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Joel.
Representative Reardon, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joel Fisher on behalf of Oregon Business Association and Associated Oregon Industries. Between the two organizations, we managed to come up with one legislative agenda that we are working on together this session. We've long been supportive of career technical education programs. We represent over 1,800 businesses, and many of them rely on an import strategy for their talent pool. We also recognize that there has been a lot of really good work done in the last few years to really improve the delivery of CTE courses in our education system, and so just want to register our support for this one piece of the many pieces that are coming together this session. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for coming in today. Any questions of either? All right, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. So I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2789, and I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill. Are she here?
She's here.
Okay.
Just here.
Hold that thought.
There she is.
She was there a second ago.
We could do a promo for our party.
Yeah, I'm ready.
I'm out of here at 4:45.
I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2439. Laura, please provide the committee with a brief summary of the bill.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2439 would allow certain students who have not received high school diploma to attend community college and to use monies that would have paid for public school to be paid for books, tuition, and fees.
Okay, great. Welcome.
First one. Thank you, Chair Reardon, members of the committee. For the record, Julie Parrish, House District 37, representing Westland and Tualatin, bringing you House Bill 2439, which is a bill for me. It's also a priority for building excellent schools together. They're not here to testify today, but I want to put that on the record. And basically, well, I want to start by telling you a story because we govern by story around here, it seems like, so I'll just give you mine. I've got three kids. They are two in high school, one in middle school. They run the spectrum of education. My oldest is on an individualized education plan, which I learned today, this week, that we give him a lot of money and then we actually don't use it on him in the classroom. So that was pretty disheartening to understand as we look at student weights and funding formulas. And then I've got one who's sort of just happy-go-lucky, middle of the road. And I've got one who is talented, gifted, and we don't spend anything on those kids either. And so my oldest, who is my IEP child, came to me in his sophomore year, beginning of his sophomore year, and he said, Mom, I want to drop out of high school. And I said, okay, kiddo, here's the deal. If you can show me that you are proficient and you can take the community college exam and you do not need to be remediated, I'll let you drop out. We'll do that. And so he went and took it, and he did need some remediation in math. And I watched a kid who has struggled his entire life in school, who is never connected. We had him in a charter school. He did well in the charter school in middle school, but he's just never connected. He's always been behind. We are arguably in one of the wealthiest school districts in the state, and he is miserable and unhappy in that school system. And watched that deal turn this kid around. And I've watched other parents in my community dealing with the same issues with their kids and letting their kids sort of move on in other ways that are maybe higher risk, but they have a safety net where those kids can be caught, right? I'm a safety net for my child, and I can write those tuition checks if he was going to move on. But I've watched this kid go from being a almost non-attender kid who struggled in school to being now decent grades in high school, on the honor roll, paid the honor roll fee last month or early last year for him to be on the honor roll at Clackamas Community College. Will is a junior in high school this year, and if he does everything he needs to do, will not have to attend his senior year, will have 30 community college and credits, and not one of those was an AP class. Because he was not my AP kiddo. So this bill is about kids like that. It's also about the kids who are in our talented gifted program who we're not funding, who arguably, if you ask them to take that community college test, there's 27,000 of those kiddos who are free and reduced. So we're also talking about kids who are low-income kids in our state. And if you gave them that same opportunity and you said, you're our kiddo until you are graduated from high school, but if you have a different way to get through college, if we have a way to take your K-12 dollars and turn that into your tuition dollars, and you don't need to be remediated, then if you're ready and your family's ready, then it's time to set you free and give you a path. I did not vote on the Oregon Promise bill in 2015 because not much of a promise if you can't fund it. These are existing dollars. When we're talking about letting kids use their K-12 dollars for higher ed, it's an existing pot of money we already fund. And so school choice, I'm a universal school choice supporter. That is not a surprise to people in this building. School choice should not just be for people who can write a check. And that's what's happening right now across our state. If you can find a different way to get your kid educated and you can pay for it, that's great. There are pathways and safety nets for you. But I was not one of those kids who had a pathway or a safety net growing up, and was the first person in my family to, well, only person in my family to graduate from high school, and the only one for years and years and years until just recently that ever had a college degree. And so to me, putting choices in, and this bill arguably takes the position that money follows the child and that those state school funds belong to our kids and not to any individual building. Giving kids this type of choice lessens the pressure that we're feeling in higher education for kids who are already academically ready to move on. And when we talk about trying to find an extra $800 for high school kids for CTE and talking about small school districts, I'm on the House Education Committee. This is my third term on that committee. When we're trying to talk about ways for small school districts to stand up STEM programs, it's a problem that $800 doesn't stand up a STEM program, but your local community college has that program. So again, if a child's academically prepared to move on, this is about letting them free and giving them those dollars and saying that we're going to make continue that K-12 investment in you, except we're going to use it to make sure that you come out with a two-year degree and that you are not in debt. So we're talking about juniors and seniors who are proficient. They can go. They do not need to be remediated. And guess what? Tuition, books, and fees at the community college cost less than what would cost to educate a kid in the K-12 scenario. So this bill also then says that the remainder of those funds, we're not talking about local dollars, we're talking about what the state appropriates, that the remainder of those dollars, that the district would get to retain one half of anything that's remaining, and that the rest of those funds, that other half, would go back into the state school fund for all kids. This is not a means-tested issue. This is about meeting a child where they're at academically and letting them take dollars we already appropriate for them and use them in the way that they see fit. So, pretty simple bill. It's only a page and a half. Could need an amendment or two, which I'd be open to. But the fact is that if we believe that the public's will fund an education for our children, if it says we'll provide a free and appropriate education for kids, does not say that the box that we do and the system that we do is the way we need to educate kids. We need to start meeting kids where they're at. We need to make sure that they are graduating. I was disheartened to hear that even a half a percent of TAG kids are in our dropout rate. These are kids who academically have no reason to be dropping out other than somehow they are not connecting with education. My youngest child, who was a TAG child, he will not like me sharing this story. We had a conference for him this week. My husband got to attend. He's my kid who has just decided he's going to boycott homework and he's done. And you know what he told me? He says, Mom, you and I know that the school district's going to pass me along anyway. They're going to move me up to the ninth grade, so I'm done doing homework. I am done giving to them and engaging with them in a way that they want me to because it's not what I want to learn. It's not anything that is in my interest, and they're not putting that information forward for me and the things that I want. So guess what? I'll just wait till ninth grade, and then we'll see how that turns out. So when my own kids, and I care about education, and when my own kids are struggling this hard in a wealthy school district, imagine what's happening to the kid in North Portland. Imagine what's happening to the kid out there in Blue Mountain Community College District, right out in rural Oregon, and we don't have programs, and we're not and making the types of investments that we need. But it's not just about the investment. It's about the choice. It's about giving families the choice to make sure that they have what they need to make their child and give them their best shot at life. So I get that there will be people who come up behind me and testify about how this takes money out of the school system, and it leaves legacy costs and stranded costs and what have you. And I appreciate all those concerns. But you know what? When my child doesn't show up in his senior year because he doesn't have to because he's already met all of his academic requirements, my school district wasn't getting a state school fund for him anyway. So, and they'll still have to deal with the legacy costs. They'll still get my property taxes, and we'll still be paying that. But the state school fund and the double weight for my child on an IEP is no longer in that school district. And I think that we're saving the state school fund some money, and that money's there for somebody else's child. So I would hope that we would start to consider bills like this, and even if it needs some amendments and it needs some fixing, but we start considering that it's about meeting children where they need to be and giving them and their families the choice. And this is the start of that conversation this year. Thanks. I'll take questions if anybody has any.
Interesting topic. Questions? Comments?
Question.
Thank you,
Rep. Mr. Sorry. Yes. Know your place. thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Representative, so I have a question on, I'm intrigued by your idea. I too have a tag kid, and I am concerned about the investments that we make in our tag youth. But when I help me answer this. So for community college and four-year college, it looks like we're spending about, I don't know, $10,000 a student on a subsidy. I could be wrong, and help me out. But remember the day before yesterday when I asked, what are we spending on each part of the spectrum? We're spending about $10,000 a student for public schools. So I think we're spending about $10,000 a student for community college and higher level. So by taking the $10,000 for a high school student and allowing them to go to a two-year college, is that not a double subsidy? My question.
So, Representative Reardon, Chair Reardon, Representative Bynum, no, this would be, so we do subsidize our higher ed, but our community colleges will tell you it is largely tuition, books, and fees are being paid by the families. And the bulk of that money is coming from the student and not from the legislature. So I don't believe it would be a double subsidy in the way I think you're thinking. There's still sort of the investment that we make in our higher ed usually is around things like bonding and those types of dollars, which we're going to make that investment, whether that kid's a junior or senior, or whether that child is, a true freshman in the truest sense. But the bulk of what I believe in talking to, like, our Clackamas Community College president is that, you know, it's the students who are picking up the tab on the bulk of the tuition, books, and fees. And so that this would cover that piece of it. It would not be, I don't believe, would be a double subsidy.
Mr. Chair, follow up. Can we ask, may I request the information for what we're spending per student, what we're investing per student?
The state school fund?
We will, definitely. I'd like to know that. I just wrote it down myself.
Okay.
Great question. Other questions?
Go with Rep. Johnson.
Oh, no, go ahead.
No, good. H before
Rep. Reschke, you're on.
Answer quick.
We'll make an exception in your case, though.
I got to get to that.
So. We have stuff we're going to do, too. So I don't think we want to be the one. Just saying. You bring up a valid question, point about tag programs. I was back at home for a school board meeting last night, and we had a presentation from our folks about our tag programs and stuff. And, you're required to do stuff for kids, but what it is pretty nondescript, and the pendulum obviously is swung in the direction, and we're all worried about at-risk kids and closing achievement gaps and all of that, and that's really, really important stuff, but we definitely we don't really challenge, there isn't a mechanism to really effectively challenge students that you're talking about, like your kid and others and so forth, and a lot of that's frankly is just we continue to have class sizes that are larger than they should be, and there's just a lot of contributing issues, and how much more can we frankly expect out of a classroom teacher in the circumstances that they find themselves in? So I agree with what you're talking about, but my apprehension, I am concerned about the complexity of, you know, moving a child from state school support, you know, common school fund supported kid. We've been dealing with this with fifth year programs, as you well know, since we've been around here, and now finally I think we've whittled that number down significantly from what it was via the Oregon Promise. Now we've got them a legitimate pathway. They can get the post-secondary, but they don't have to do it on state school fund dollars and so forth. So I'm just a little, if there's a way to flesh this out and make it a little more, you know, certain, you know, I could feel more, you know, positive about it. But it just seems like there's a lot of questions about how that would work out, and just to make sure again that we're not providing post-secondary opportunities on the back of the K-12 support, you know, and that's just where I'm concerned.
Well, Chair Reardon, Representative Johnson, I guess, you know, it starts with where you personally philosophically align, right? If we're going to have a kiddo from kindergarten to grade 12, and we're going to have them for 13 years, and let's say the average per student funding is $10,000 a year on average per kid, I think that's about where we're at right now for Oregon, then using that lens and saying, okay, this is what my child is worth, then as a parent, where I align philosophically is that those dollars move around with my kid regardless of which branch he's in. And that's us starting to think about, as legislators and policymakers, about how we blend that line. You know, there's programs right now, like there's a program in my old school district where I graduated high school in Colorado, where they are making sure that not only do those kids leave with the four-year, they leave with their associates in CTE programs, right? And so they're actually doing that inside the walls of the K-12 setting, right? And so other states are being much more forward-thinking about how to blend these dollars down, and we are still set in the box that pre-K is this, and K-12 is this, and higher ed is this, and they all have their own different unions, and everybody's going to come and fight for money, instead of actually looking at those dollars on a continuum for a kid and saying, how much does it really cost to educate my kid? And it might not be that my kid needs a full $130,000, and I'm okay with that as a parent. And it might be that somebody else's kid needs a little more. But if we start to break down those walls, then I think that's where you get there, right? I mean, the conversation around fifth-year programs has been, well, it's a fifth year and it's higher ed or whatever. This is saying, let's get those kiddos who are ready to go now before they would, you know, stick around for a fifth year. And maybe we have some kids sticking around for fifth year because that's how they're getting that free tuition. And this is saying, what about kids who are already done? Right? And there are a lot of kids in our high school system that are already ready to go. And we keep them there because of age, or we keep them there because that's how we've always done it, and this is the box we put kids in, and this is what we expect out of high school. So this is a bill that challenges the assumption that every kid walks out the door at 18, or the goal is that they walk out of 18. Some are ready to leave at 16. Some are ready to leave at 15, even sooner. But also saying that if we're going to put a dollar amount on that child, that it should move through the continuum. Right, and maybe if we make a little bit higher investment in that child in before they can't read in third grade, right, then they can get out sooner on the back end. And so it's just a rethinking of how these dollars get used. And other states are starting to really engage in this conversation in a way that I think Oregonians haven't. Although, ironically, as somebody who sort of is nerdy and does a lot of polling of voters, this is where Oregon families want us to go. They're ready for this conversation. It's us who is sort of behind the curve on engaging in the conversation, which is why we continue to sort of bring these ideas forward.
I think, as always, you bring great questions and challenge our philosophies. I would just ask a couple of real quick questions.
Sure.
And we have do have another person right behind you. Well, more of a comment, really, is you raised a question, you didn't mention it, but it's sort of the seat time versus proficiency and when you advance the child. So that might fit into this conversation as well. So some kids are ready to move on quicker than others. So I think recognizing, you know, that. Just have to ask, is in your mind, is there sort of an age of reason? You mentioned your son at eighth grade deciding. He made up his mind. I at eighth grade was pretty much told what to do and when to do it and how high to jump and everything. And I know this is a different age, but philosophically, is there kind of an age limit? And
well, I don't know if there's that much an age limit, right? I mean, we see kids who are, you know, again, a lot of times based on families with resources whose children jumpstart and sort of bypass, you know, all of high school, right, and go straight into college or what have you. I don't know that this bill is about dealing with kids who at least have sort of been in the traditional K-12 four-year high school type, because, you know, we're actually saying juniors and seniors in this bill. But, I mean, again, I think that sort of falls on the family. This bill, we're going to limit that, but you really could have kids who are smart and talented and ready to move on, and for lots of different reasons. And
surprisingly, I have had kids that are smart and were ready to move on, so I've experienced some of the same things.
And do we do those children a service when we leave them tethered to a chair because this is what our statutes say, that this is where the statute says they're supposed to be? And I would argue that's not the most beneficial thing for a child.
Good question. Referred?
Yeah, a couple things. I have met the representative's children, and I can honestly witness to the fact that her children are exactly the way she described them. Very articulate, very well-spoken, very opinionated, very strong personalities. I know that shocked us.
They get it from their dad.
Yeah, right.
Just put that out
there. But I mean, that's actually a very high compliment.
Yeah.
And I may not be considered the Rep Johnson or Cliff Bentz of the legislature, but as someone that saw high school as kind of a prison for me, honestly, I can relate to what she's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some personalities, some intellects just don't work well within certain boxes, and so I was just dying to get out of high school. The only reason I finished was because of sports, frankly.
Yeah.
So I'm interested in the concept.
You know, even I was known to escape Kelso High School a little early some days. So.
Yeah.
Well, and Chair Reardon, Representative Hurd, you know, I met your dad. I would not have put you in a box as a student, knowing who your family is, that for some of the other programs where we have like expanded options for kids that are at risk, you wouldn't have been considered an at-risk kid under that. My kid's not considered at risk at that, but they maybe just be ready to go on. And so this is, like I said, it's about putting a choice in and letting families have some control over, you know, where education meets their child and meets the needs of their child.
Okay. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. On to the next fun one. Thank you.
Ms. Wimmer, would you care to join us?
There's so many things that that
could be. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer, representing 44,000 members of the Oregon Education Association at the K-12 and community college levels. And we are here to respectfully oppose the bill before you, House Bill 2439. I'll just speak to some of the high points. My written testimony is in the OLA system. First of all, I'd like to point out that we, too, believe that innovation that is student-centered is a great way to go as we think about how best to approach and improve our public education system. Our members have been on the forefront of educational innovations over the decades, and so we too, agree that we always want to look for ways to respond to the independent needs of our students and not just systematize them. But we do believe that this bill, in its approach, is fiscally unwise, and it also duplicates other efforts that are already underway in our system. We have more than 33,000 students now, according to the Department of Ed and HEC, who I spoke to about this, in various different programs, among them one that was just mentioned by Representative Parrish, the Expanded Options Program, which I had the opportunity to be a part of a work group to create. That program specifically targets the kinds of kids who don't have the resources for their parents to pay for them to pursue educational options. And they have, if you will, a right of first refusal in the door to use some of their state school fund dollars, with parameters and sideboards that help districts not fiscally be at sea. And there are some readiness components to make sure that the students are truly ready to go to a community college setting where the average age of a student is 35. And so we have that program. Right now it has 238 students in it, and then there are a number of other community college-related programs that use public dollars that students in our our public system can avail themselves of that are very carefully thought through with the kinds of fiscal constraints that help districts manage all of the programs for all of the kids, as I think Representative Johnson was alluding to. School choice doesn't mean that the state should choose policies that advantage the few at the expense of the many. When you destabilize school funding for a school, particularly in these times where we're staring down such a big fiscal hole, what you're doing is you're saying that the vast majority of the students who now have fewer programs in their high school because resources are going out the door, that those kids don't count in the equations about school choice. And that's not true. We think that we need to consider the best interests of all students in our system. So for all of those reasons, we would ask that you not move this bill. We don't see a way to move a higher ed voucher bill that isn't necessary because we already are serving those needs in a time when we are so fiscally constrained, certainly. And I'd be happy to take your questions if you have any.
Okay. Any questions, comments?
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. I can just read this. Our crack research team came up with a number response, and you said you think it's a community college number? Mm-hmm. Community college, Heck responded that it's $31.47 per student.
Average tuition?
Subsidy. And which begs the question, I'm really not sure I know the cost per year for tuition, so what the student part is. But
yeah. Gene, just $3,147 per student. What's that number mean?
Question.
That's for community college.
There was a charge.
The subsidy is $3,147 per student. Is that what we're
saying?
That's
what our research shows.
State support.
Okay.
General fund support, I guess, is what you'd say.
I'd still like to follow up and see if that's consistent what it is at college level as well.
University level, and then also at the high school level.
Okay, at the top of his tongue over. He knows all that stuff.
Come on. Bring it up. John,
would you like to come forward, sir?
Gang thing or what?
He's looking at
something.
He's like, I can't tell you guys. I don't know.
Please re-identify yourself.
Bandana.
Just very quickly, the state share of the total cost of a annual community college education is that $3,147. And then the student pays about almost 50% of full freight right now. And then the rest is property tax. But so that total cost is in about the $10,000 range. Oh, the state share is about a third of that. That's the $3,147. But that's just the state share of the total cost.
And that's for a year?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or which is three terms? Or?
Yeah.
Okay.
At 15 credits a term.
Rep, wasn't it?
Thank you. Sure, wasn't it? Thank you, Mr. Chair. John, I think it's clear to, should be made clear, community college is not like the K-12, which is constitutionally required that each student gets the same amount, and that the local property tax plays a much more significant role in funding community colleges percentage-wise than PK-12, which is, again, supposed to balance out. At one time, Central Oregon Community College was really considering leaving the state because they weren't getting any funding from the state through the distribution formula. Isn't that correct?
Chair Reardon, Representative Wisnett, because we equalize property taxes, it does, or we have an equalization formula that looks at property taxes, that can affect a college's share out of the formula.
Mr. Chair, my fault. But
please.
But I think one of the big changes since I've been here in the community colleges, when I first came in, community colleges, the state provided no funding for community college buildings or facilities. And now we're doing that, and we have a rank order of doing it. I think that's improved our community college facilities tremendously. We were using funeral homes or something for community colleges on the coast. So the state's played a bigger role in community college funding as far as construction, but the per student and the allocation is more difficult and not as definitely not like anything like the PK-12.
Yeah. But. Well, I think we can get some more information that covers a broader spectrum of education and kind of breaks it down a little bit more. So thank you for the volunteering to jump up. We'll get more information. I think we can cover that in greater depth. Okay. I think anyone from the public wants to testify? Good. I'm closing public hearing on House Bill 2439. And I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2313. Laura, please provide the committee with a brief summary.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2313 would revise types of programs considered accelerated college credit programs by adding sponsored dual credit programs and assessment-based learning programs. It expands the annual academic achievement report requirement to include sponsored dual credit and assessment-based learning programs. There is a -1 amendment, members. Creates task force on accelerated learning to decide how to implement equitable and sustainable funding for accelerated college credit program.
Thank you, Laura. And we have Aaron, Dr. Roselli, and Janelle Ives. Friends, they can come up together. And thank you for being here. Is the amendment ready? I didn't see it this morning. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, and whoever would like to go first.
Thank you. I think we'll go in the same order. Hello, Chair Reardon, Vice Chair Wisnett, members of the committee. My name is Dr. Erin Weeks-Earp. I'm with the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. I'm here today to provide background information on our bill, HB 2313, with the -1 amendments, which updates accelerated learning statutes and establishes the task force for sustainable funding for accelerated college credit programs and transitional supports. So first, I want to tell you why the statutes need updating. Dual credit is in our statutes in a couple of places. And in June 2016, the HEC added two new types of accelerated learning standards along with the dual credit standards. They're called sponsored dual credit and assessment-based learning credit. This action provides greater flexibility to school districts and partnering colleges and universities for the development of accelerated learning programs while increasing the likelihood that credits awarded under these new models will be recognizable and transferable to other higher education institutions. So at this time, it is important that these two new types of accelerated learning have the same legal footing as their dual credit counterpart, and so we're proposing to add them to the existing statute language. As a bit of background, the Joint Boards of Education, back when they existed, adopted the Oregon dual credit standards. That was in 2010. The HEC adopted the dual credit standards in 2014 with an update, and that was in accordance with Chapter 34310, which is about college credit in the high school. The new two types of standards that we're asking be inserted into the language today were developed working closely with the public universities and the community colleges in our state. HEC crafted the standards with a work group, and these were vetted widely and adopted in 2016. So those two types, I want to tell you a little bit about them. Assessment-based learning credit. That's where enhanced high school courses or other activities offered at the high school are taught by high school teachers, focus on student attainment of specific college or university defined student learning outcomes. In these programs, students have the opportunity to demonstrate through college or university assessments that they've attained those student learning outcomes and thereby earn credit for a course from the sponsoring college or university. So that's what we're calling ABL, or assessment-based learning credit. Sponsored dual credit is a college or university course offered as part of the high school program at the high school, taught by a high school teacher in partnership with a sponsoring college or university faculty member who meets the qualifications to teach the course at the college or university. Sponsored dual credit students enroll in the college courses, and their grading and transcription is consistent with those of like courses at the college or university. So those are the two types that we're
adding. Do we interrupt as you go along? Is that
question?
Could you talk a little bit about the required qualifications of the high school teacher?
The high school teacher
is hired to participate in this work or invited to participate in this work by the academic department in the college or the university. So there isn't necessarily a statewide standard about their qualifications, but those would be determined by the institution who's partnering.
So when they're teaching this class, they're considered to be an employee of the community college?
Not necessarily an employee, but definitely a partner. And in each partnership, that relationship is defined uniquely. The standards go into many areas where the faculty and at the university or college and the faculty at the high school must work together closely. So they must show evidence of that relationship in order to be an approved program.
And if they don't?
And if they don't, they receive a recommendation to improve, much like other higher education accreditation processes work. Okay. And if they don't, then they wouldn't be approved.
Okay.
Shall I continue? Thank you, Representative Reardon. So, again, House Bill 2313 requires all public universities and colleges in the state of Oregon who offer accelerated college credit, because they don't all offer it, to report to the HEC student participation in dual credit, sponsored dual credit, and assessment-based learning credit. As these data are submitted and become available, the HEC looks forward to being able to track the impact of accelerated learning on student post-secondary success, including enrollment and degree and certificate completion. So just to summarize the result of the change in the statute that are proposed here, accelerated college credit is possible through a secondary post-secondary partnership, and those entail significant planning, resources, and collaboration from both the secondary and post-secondary side. The HEC Standards and Oversight Committee guidance helps partnerships show how they provide credits with a purpose and academic integrity. Once these four statutes are updated, all three types of accelerated college credit will have equal footing, and the possibilities for productive partnerships that support students' college readiness, graduation, and post-secondary success and completion will be more flexible and far-reaching. So specifically, the four statutes that are in this 17-page bill are 340-300. That's where the school districts, so ODE school districts, are required to provide accelerated college credit programs. 340-310, that's where HEC is responsible for providing standards for accelerated college credit programs. 340-320, that's where ODE administers grants for special programs and teachers, teacher training and accelerated college credit. And lastly, there's a place that we found that HEC and the State Board of Education shall enhance the use and quality of. It said dual credit, but we're asking it to say accelerated college credit programs, just to encompass all three and make sure that all three have a good standing as we move forward. Very briefly to the amendment, the formation of the task force is a critical next step in this process, where the three education agencies that are here today as well will collaborate to explore solutions around equitable funding and the additional transition supports that are necessary to support students. Our colleague Dr. Hilda Roselli is here to share more about the task force, and Janelle Ives is here to share the ODE perspective on these bills. I also want to mention that we review John Wyckoff's OCCA written testimony, and we're ready to work with John to incorporate some of those carefully worded ideas into this bill as well.
Okay, so I need to ask you guys to wrap up in about 5 minutes, if that's possible. I know you can talk.
I don't
about
know.
We have some unexpected folks that also want to say a few words on this
certainly.
Bill. So.
Sure.
Tighter than I expected.
So good afternoon, Chair Reardon and Vice Chair Wisnett and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Hilda Roselli. I'm Policy Director for College and Career Readiness in the Chief Education Office, and it is a great opportunity to explain more about why we are supportive of the -1 amendments for House Bill 2313. Our ambitious 40-40-20 goals has focused our state's efforts to really focus on developing a college-going culture and give more equitable exposure for students to the kinds of experiences that help them think about post-high school endeavors. And in 2012, you may remember that Eastern Promise Project really started a whole movement towards increasing access to early college credit. And I would point out that their initiative that we've been following very carefully over the years now has resulted in very positive improvements in attendance at high school, graduation rates, and college enrollment rates, and we're now getting ready to follow their persistence once they're in college. What's unique about this is it is not just putting credits there for the purpose of credits. It's based on five pillars. One is creating a college-going culture. Secondly, closing the access gap that existed for many students who didn't have the opportunity to enroll in the courses, and also giving a variety of accelerated college credit opportunities. But more important, the commitment to cross-sector collaboration. As was mentioned earlier, this takes time between faculty and teachers to work together, and also bringing in some of the other resources of communities that want to see this kind of work promoted. Since 2014-15, the Oregon State Legislature has invested in programs like this that have increased the number of high school students that are completing these courses. These are done through grants that are coordinated in consortiums made up of school districts, education service districts, and post-secondary partners. These regional promise projects in 2014-15 actually served higher percentages of students in poverty, students of color, and students in rural schools than any other type of accelerated courses. These types of projects are particularly relevant when you look at the research, and I'm going to share this because this is really important. A learner's high school experiences, their academic achievements, and their academic identity shape their perceptions of college and whether or not they see themselves fit for college. And so when we look at the scripts that students bring sometimes to the table based on race, socioeconomic status, and potential, it can be inverted and improved when we give them those experiences. So why do we need this Dash One Amendment? Very important that you have already heard even today that there are issues that have not been resolved yet. We have not yet figured out a sustainable funding mechanism to make sure that the work that is required of high school partners and post-secondary partners is funded equitably. We still know from the data that there are inequities across zip codes, rural communities, and students that are traditionally underrepresented in higher ed. We must figure that out. We have not yet totally resolved the instructor qualification issue. We have not yet looked at the alignment of curriculum in the way that it is sustainable. And so you will see here that we have proposed these amendments to convene a task force to come back to you with recommendations on how to sustain this work because we know of the value that it creates. The Chief Education Office is committed to working with all partners on this and putting together the kinds of collaborative discussions that will result in very positive, proactive solutions. Thank you.
Okay. Janelle, she took your five. She took all the 5 minutes. I want to point that out. So
I have negative one?
Pretty much.
Okay. Chair Reardon, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Janelle Ives. I'm from the Oregon Department of Education, the Accelerated Learning Specialist. I'll be very brief because we've heard a lot about this. I just wanted to talk about some of the power and change that we've seen because of these regional promise programs. In rural schools that participate, we had a more than doubling of students participating in accelerated learning. For Native American students in these schools, it jumped from 8% participating in accelerated learning in 1 year to 38% of Native Americans taking accelerated learning opportunities. So there is a huge benefit from having multiple models, and we look forward to working in this task force to find sustainable methods of funding for this so that it can be available to all students across the state.
Great job. Vice Chair Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you all for your testimony. I think everyone's proud of what this program, the state should be for. The task force is not stopping someone in school now or next year from continuing to take the, and I wish you success. I wish if it's a tie, it should go in the favor of the student or the him availability. I hope you'll exercise that judgment. Thank you.
Any questions, comments? Yeah, Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the pratfalls of being on this committee for four sessions is sometimes it seems like deja vu all over again. You know, I'm just trying to count back the numbers of task forces that we've had to deal with issues like this. And, Hilda, you remember this one, House Bill 3418, which you and I served on back in 11, which is slightly different. I mean, it's primarily on removing or trying to remove roadblocks for higher ed students and so forth. But, again, we consider institutional and statutory barriers to student success and completion of programs. Examine methods for students to acquire basic skills and career preparation skills, alternative funding options. I mean, all those things were there. We had a long task force. We met. We came back and made a recommendation, and we're still here. We still have roadblocks in the road. Fast forward a couple years to the Accelerated Learning Task Force that just finished up prior to the 2015 session, which was, again, I think you had Senator Haas, I think you had Representative Huffman, I think, that served. And, again, recommendations that come back, but yet here we are 2 years later saying we need another task force. So I don't mean to be cynical or critical, but I'm just saying we could be at one of these crossroads in this topic, just like I think we are in the credit transfer topic, where it's time for maybe a legislative stick to say, let's just get this thing done. So we have models out there that work via the Eastern Promise. Maybe we just need to say, thou shalt make this happen somehow, and so forth, and kind of spare everybody the, you know, the magical mystery tour of another task force. But you outline real problems and real issues, I get it, but we've been studying these things, and I'm just questioning whether getting everybody in the room again to talk about it is really going to get any better outcomes.
Go ahead.
Chair Reardon and Representative Johnson, I believe that one of the things that happens is that iterative processes sometimes are bolstered by the data and the engaged innovation that has been occurring, and that did not occur earlier in some of those efforts. And I really believe that we now have a lot more evidence about what it is that we have to do differently, and I would hope that the task force would be using that to bring you forward the kinds of recommendations. But yes, I do remember all of those groups.
Thank you.
Rep. Johnson, thank you for your years of service on this.
It's not okay. Easy being me.
Anything else? Thank you for coming in today. Appreciate it. And we have Kevin Burry and is it Morgan? Mm-hmm. Morgan Alton and Ozzie Rose.
Morgan Allen.
Same rooms. Let's see.
Now you're going to get some wisdom. Ozzie was here when this building was built.
Shut up.
Oh. That's right. I understand your handwriting. Okay. It's because Ozzie, you're the senior
chairman,
senior gentleman. I'm sure. So. Welcome.
I'm also the one that doesn't write real clearly. That's Morgan Allen, not Morgan. Morgan. Excuse me. I'm Ozzie Rose. I represent the Oregon Association ESDs, and our issue is the transfer credit. Issue. The current situation is that a student can complete accelerated course of some kind, get college credit in one institution, transcript, everything, and then if they go to transfer to a certain institution, they won't accept the credit. And that could be fixed by rule or by practice mm-hmm. or by statute. That the colleges need to do this. If we're truly going to talk about 40-40-20, and hey, we have a P20 system. A P20 system requires that we go ahead with what we, and these courses were developed over time with schools and universities under the chancellor's office, and continued work will surely go on as new courses are brought on board. But when a kid takes the course, gets the credit, and then goes to another institution and told it doesn't count, that's a disservice to the system and to the kids. And I'll leave it to you to decide right now whether we need statute or something else. But we need either practice change, rule change, or statutory change. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rose.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Morgan Allen here on behalf of the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, and I know time is short, so we'll cut right to the chase. You heard all the successes of regional promise programs like Eastern Promise. The legislature's invested millions of dollars in those programs, and over, you know, since 40-40-20 went into effect, our K-12 school districts that are engaged in these partnerships have basically been operating under what I would call a general persons agreement, that if the kids get these credits through the regional promise programs, that they will be transferable amongst Oregon institutions of higher education. And to just go a little further than us, we recently had our first instance of an institution of higher education saying a credit was not valid or they would not accept it. That was a credit from another institution of higher education in the state in a regional promise program here at the Willamette Promise. And we know there's going to be some meetings that are happening very soon where all those parties are going to sit down and try to talk through that and figure out a way to see if they can come to some common understanding about whether or not to accept those credits. But as you might imagine, our superintendents and administrators in these programs are pretty spun up. And as a matter of fact, some people I've known for a long time are about as spun up as I've seen them about anything that's happened in the last 10 years or so. And so we're supportive of the bill, we're supportive of the task force, and we're supportive of any kind of formal or informal conversations that can resolve this issue. But again, we're running smack dab into the whole problem that all this 40-40-20 and OEIB stuff was supposed to fix. We're supposed to have a seamless P20 system. We're supposed to think about the kids. It's supposed to be student-centered. It's not supposed to be about bickering amongst adults about who's accredited or who's the best person to teach these courses. And so that's why we're here today, and we just want to put that on the record. This bill happens to have the right relating clause if we can't get some resolution to this issue. So we hope that we can, and we hope that the adults will figure out a solution to this problem. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Morgan. Appreciate your input. Mr. Furry, how are you?
Chairman Reardon, members of the House Higher Ed Committee, I want to thank you for allowing me to testify today. My name is Dr. Kevin Fury, and I am a economics instructor at Chemeketa Community College and a resident of Bend, Oregon. And I come here to speak against House Bill 2330. And in particular, I suggest that you strike the words everywhere in the bill, sponsor dual credit programs and assessment-based learning programs. These two new models for accelerated learning have a set of interrelated negative incentives which give a very high probability that over time these are going to be very low quality educational options. To go through all of them would take a lot of time, but let me just focus on primarily on one of them. And that is a tendency for transmutation of goals. The basic goal of accelerated learning is to give high school kids an opportunity to be able to experience college culture, college level rigor, so that it makes it much easier for them to transition from high school into college. But that goal can easily be transmuted into one of, let us try to save kids money, let us try to save them time, let us try to get them as many college credits in high school as possible. The first goal, quality, stands shoulder to shoulder with the goal. In the second one, quality education, quality courses stand in opposition to getting students as many credits as possible. You put that together with the fact that these models will allow high schools to shop around to different college institutions for the easiest to pass credits. You put that together with the idea that in these models there's no guarantee that there's going to be college instructors cross-grading these assessments. You put together with that the fact that supposedly the college instructors are going to be the guarantors of quality, yet there's nothing in these models that doesn't allow the colleges to hire part-time faculty whose workload and continuances may be dependent on the success of these courses. You put those together with the other negative incentives in these models, and you have a recipe, or at least a potential recipe, for disaster. These are untried, dangerous, experimental models, and I would recommend that you give them your stamp of disapproval by voting no on this particular measure and sending back to the HEC and asking them to develop high-quality models for expanding accelerated learning. Thank you all very much.
Okay. Interesting. Questions, comments? Okay. Thank you all very much for your questions or for your coming in today. Appreciate that. And I think that's it. Okay. I'm closing the House Bill 2313, opening a public hearing on House Bill 2147. Laura, please provide the committee with a brief summary.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2147 would require each post-secondary institution of education to provide the Department of Education Higher Education Coordinating Commission with number of high school graduates from each school district enrolled at the institution and graduation rate at institution for Oregon high school graduates from each school district.
Thank you. And we are pleased to welcome Rep. Johnson. And Richard, are you still with us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, Mark Johnson from beautiful House District 52. So this is a very simple bill. It's actually one that was suggested to me by my superintendent, Dan Goldman, there's testimony from him that's in OLIS that he submitted today, but it gets to the nexus of, again, a very simple, it's something that I think most of us would assume is happening regularly, but from the superintendent's perspective, and as you'll hear from OSBA here, it is not happening as frequently as it should or as clear as it should, but basically it's about reporting, and it's about requiring that every post-secondary every institution in the state, any college, university, report back to the school districts what students are enrolling in their institution, how they're doing, and are they in fact graduating. There isn't that automatic pipeline of communication right now, and as you can imagine, it can be frustrating and difficult for a high school or a school district to be able to track, you know, success rates. If you have multiple high schools within a district, you have a better retention rate from one high school and another high school, you might look and say, okay, how are these kids being better prepared? Is it simply demographics that are different? Are we teaching different? What's the deal here? And also to have district comparisons as well. If students from Rep. Wisnett's district in Central Oregon are persisting better than students from, you know, East County or somewhere or Happy Valley, you might wonder what's the difference here. But right now there isn't an automatic recording mechanism for this. So this just reporting mechanism. So this just requires that each year that each institution will report regularly to ODE and to the HEC so that they have that information. And that can then be communicated to the school districts. It seems like a very common sense fix. It currently isn't in place, and it seems like a fairly easy fix. Now, I will mention that ODE has brought to our attention that there is an entity called the National Student Clearinghouse that does compile names and birth dates of Oregon High School graduates. And post-secondary institutions provide enrollment data, but it doesn't necessarily link those to high schools. It doesn't necessarily give us the demographic information to know exactly where they're from and what high schools they graduated from. So there's data out there. It's just time to tie these loops here so that we clearly understand what's going on, how our students are being prepared, and how they're faring once they leave high school and so forth. So with that, I'll turn it over to my good colleague here from OSBA.
But I can wait if you want.
Thank you, Representative Reardon, Chair Reardon, members of the committee. Richard Donovan, on behalf of the Oregon School Boards Association, thank you for allowing me to testify on behalf of House Bill 2147. As Representative Johnson said, House Bill 2147 is simple, it's straightforward, and very valuable. It would cause or mandate that all post-secondary institutions in the state would tell ODE and the HEC where their students in Oregon came from and how they got there. It's a piece of information that's generally lacking today. It's valuable because we don't know a lot, particularly in the realm of private post-secondary institution. You know, I'm lucky enough to have some school board members, current and former, on this committee. School board members, parents, all kind of education stakeholders understand anecdotally very well what's up with their kids, what's up with their students. But that anecdotal evidence doesn't have any sort of objective, tracked metric that we in Oregon use or maintain currently. This would be valuable. So when somebody says, you know, my students in Eastern Oregon or in Representative Hurd's district, you know, they have higher graduation rates but lower throughputs, there's no way for us right now to know what that means. You know, if there's a program or good work being done in one district that can be transferred to another, or even kind of the longer term effects of some of the promise programs that were mentioned earlier in the bill, in the hearing preceding this one. This bill is very simple. We're very happy to support it, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Rep. Shulman.
Thank you, Chair. I would agree that this is a missing link, not only on all the points that Representative, I just would concur on all the points that Representative Johnson said. I have the benefit of also being on the Education Committee, and we recently had a presentation on a something through the I believe it's through the Department of Education that's doing a it's kind of a system set in place for this, so to help in this process. So hopefully those worlds can connect, and this is something that can work together. I would support this as well, and it's really important as we're looking at all these programs and for planning purposes and for the fact that we want to make sure that the courses that we're teaching our students in our schools really do transfer and really do have that give that seamless transfer for our transition for our students. So I think it's great. Just wanted to say.
And just to piggyback off that, you know, Chair Reardon, Representative Solomon, as the whole legislature in the state kind of faces an expansion in the areas of CTE as a result of ballot measure 98, mm-hmm. these are the, you know, these kinds of things. We believe in the efficacy of those kinds of programs, but it would be great if we could see actually which programs perhaps are sending kids where students moving forward, this could be even more valuable. And there's, I don't think there's anybody from ODE in the room to knock around the longitudinal database, which is what Representative Solomon.
Okay.
Then I will defer to Representative Johnson.
Representative, I hope they didn't promise you a longitudinal data system. They've been promising me that since 2011. So. That's why we're kind of taking the bull by the horns.
Yeah. And can I follow up?
Oh, please.
Thank you. Representative Springer, both, I think she was also part of that process and said, I think she said 6 years. She was excited to be able to say, look at what's happening. So she was also saying that as well. And to touch on, I do have a follow-up question, though, because we talk a lot about post-secondary. Does that include our apprenticeship programs and how that would work, too? Because I do want to make sure that as we're venturing down these CTE pathways and excitingly venturing down those pathways, is how are we able to show that those students have enrolled in, like, trade schools as well? So,
Rep. Solomon, at this point, we're just talking about colleges and universities.
Baby steps.
I think we'd have to identify, you know, the programs in question that you're referring to, and maybe there's a way to connect with them as well.
Okay.
There may be other opportunities to do that.
Okay.
But a good point, very good point.
So are you saying that your members have asked for this information? I just want to be crystal clear on it, that the school board members are asking for this. And,
Representative
and
Reed,
they would,
we haven't.
And they would actually use it.
Chair Reed and members of the committee, we have not had a formal kind of OSBA-wide policy request, but we very frequently get requests individually and for, at the board level for this kind of information.
Yeah.
This is the kind of thing that boards really like to know. As board members can attest to, yeah.
Measurable goals.
Well, definitely like data, but I also want to know that we're going to use it.
I'll be happy to follow up with that, too.
Okay, thank you.
Well, just to follow up, Mr. Chair, you know, again, I'm a 12-year school board member in my district, but I can't tell you where we enrolled high school graduates last year. We just don't
They just go forth and
they're,
prosper,
they're
right?
Out. I mean, we know they're going somewhere. We kind of know where they go if they... You know, communicate with our Aspire program, we place them, and we know who, you know, gets support, but where they go, how they persist, and how many actually graduate on time, or in 4 years, or 6 years, or how many. We don't have that data.
Okay. Very good.
Follow up comment. Really quick.
Well, this would
I
be
mean,
a
I'm
new,
say it
this would be
even...
a new comment. And just because we're getting done early, don't overdo it now.
Okay.
I yield mine to her. I'm okay.
Thanks, buddy. thank you, Chair. But I think also the important part about the remedial, you know, is wanting to make sure that we have those, you know, that we're the courses that we're teaching and where they're, you know, able to, the classes that they're able to take in college, so that they're investing their dollars and getting in there. And
I just thought of a question. So this says specifically where they enroll, and maybe 2-4 years later, where when they graduate, would we also be able to identify if when they leave the institution, if they leave prior to? So if somebody's, you know, how long is somebody in a particular institution? So the HEC will probably be annoyed at me for even thinking of that, but I think it'd be really something to consider.
I agree, Mr. Chair. I think it's
how long do they endure the program?
Information. I think you're right.
Yeah. Okay. Sounds good. Anything else? All right. I am closing public hearing on House Bill 2147. I am closing early a meeting of the Higher House Higher Ed Workforce Development Committee.
Whoa.
Development Committee.